This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
Crime and Crime Again is a true crime podcast containing subject matter that may be graphic or disturbing. Listener discretion is advised.
On a warm spring evening in Snellville, Georgia, shoppers bustled in and out of the Target store at the Presidential Market Shopping Center. Dozens of people going about their typical shopping routines, carting bags out to their cars, while attempting to herd restless children away from the surrounding parking lot traffic. But what no one shopping at the Target that day expected to hear while trying to remember where exactly they parked their car was a horrifying scream, followed by the pop of a gunshot. At 6:03 p.m. on April 26, 2009, local dispatch received a 911 call alerting them that someone had just been shot in the parking lot of the local Target. The caller stated that witnesses watched a man shoot a woman in the head before walking away. The woman was lying motionless near the rear driver's side of her vehicle. Frantically, the caller then relayed that the woman had a baby in her vehicle, strapped into a car seat and crying. The first officer on the scene was still a rookie at the time, and he had not yet bore witness to such a violent crime scene. The woman was lying on her back, blood pooling on the pavement beneath her head. Despite his shock, the officer acted quickly, grabbing the distressed baby from his mother's vehicle and putting him safely into a patrol car. Investigators converged on the scene and began the process of identifying the woman. Her purse was found in the passenger seat of her SUV, and inside of it was her wallet, containing her ID. The woman, who had been killed in front of her young son, was identified as 25-year-old Heather Stroob. Heather Suzanne Allen was born on April 20, 1984, in Snellville, Georgia, to parents Buddy and Mary Allen. Heather was the older of two children. Her little brother Henry was born when Heather was about 4 years old. Heather was an active, boisterous child growing up. She got involved in several different activities and sports, including gymnastics and cheerleading, and she was always eager to try and learn new things. According to her family, Heather was funny and charismatic. She loved making people smile, and she carried that with her throughout her life. The family was devout in their faith, and after many years of attending the same church, they decided it was time to find a new church. After finding Calvary Chapel, in a town not far from Snellville, the family decided that it would be their new home for worship. At the time, Heather was 16 years old, and she started attending the teen youth program at Calvary Chapel. It was there that she met 16-year-old Stephen Stroob. The two quickly hit it off and started dating. They had a loving, fun relationship, and it was clear to everyone that Heather and Stephen would become a high school sweetheart love story. When Heather was 17, she started working part-time at a local flower shop, and this nurtured a newfound passion for her. She fell in love with floral design, and that is perhaps part of the reason why, when Heather's parents decided to move to Covington, Georgia, they also opened up their own flower shop called Blooms Flowers and Gifts. Soon, the family bought another local flower shop called Flowers of Old Town. This was a dream job for Heather. She worked with her mother Mary to run the shops, but Heather worked primarily as a floral designer. She even did consultations for weddings and other events. She loved the creativity she could express within her job. And even more than that, she loved the joy that flowers brought to every customer. After high school, Heather went on to attend Perimeter College, followed by Auburn University, and she earned a business degree. Her dream was to continue running her own business at the flower shops. In May 2004, Heather and Stephen got married, and she became Heather Suzanne Stroob. A few years went by, and in September 2007, Heather and Stephen welcomed baby Carson into the world. Heather fell in love with motherhood, and both she and Stephen were incredibly hands-on parents with Carson. Heather's parents, Buddy and Mary, were thrilled to be grandparents, and Stephen's mother, Joanna, also played an active role in Carson's life and loved spending as much time with him as she could. Heather soon returned to work at the flower shop, and because it was her family-owned business, she was able to bring baby Carson with her to work every day. Stephen's mother, Joanna, had actually started helping out with the business whenever she had a few free hours. She would often help when the shops were at their busiest, running the front desk, taking orders, or making flower deliveries as needed. This was also an opportunity for Joanna to see Carson as much as possible, since he was often at the shop with Heather. But this was where some underlying tension became obvious to Heather's family and friends. According to friends of Heather, there were occasions where Joanna would come into the shop, put Carson in his stroller, and head out the door with him, without consulting Heather. Heather quickly put a stop to this and expressed to her mother-in-law that she was not comfortable with her taking her son whenever she pleased. Heather was completely willing to let Joanna be active in Carson's life, but she was not willing to allow Joanna to overstep her boundaries. There were also instances, according to Heather's family and friends, where Joanna openly disagreed with Heather's parenting style and methods, despite the fact that everyone close to Heather fully believed that she was an excellent mother and was devoted to raising her son in a healthy, loving home. And this wasn't the only source of conflict in Heather's personal life. As tensions mounted between Heather and her mother-in-law, Heather had also begun to suspect that her husband, Stephen, might have been unfaithful. Her suspicions were confirmed when it was Joanna who approached Heather and gave her a receipt for a piece of jewelry that Stephen had purchased. When Heather saw the receipt, she knew that her husband had stepped outside of their marriage. She had not received any jewelry from Stephen. Although Heather was deeply against divorce, it wasn't long before she decided that the best thing for her and for her son was for her and Stephen to go their separate ways. By March 2008, the divorce was in progress, and Heather and Stephen had already formed a custody arrangement. Heather would have primary custody of Carson, and Stephen would get him every other weekend. Although emotions were running high, Heather and Stephen were making an effort to be amicable. Sometime in the spring of 2008, Heather was introduced to Mike Vickers, a restaurant manager who was also in the process of a divorce. They clicked almost instantly and began a relationship. Those close to Heather recalled that she and Mike were smitten with each other. Mike quickly became close with Carson, and only a few months into their relationship, Heather and Mike were discussing marriage and kids. Over time, for reasons that aren't completely clear, Heather decided that going forward, she wanted to make custody exchanges in public places. There were reports from family and friends that Heather felt uncomfortable, and possibly even unsafe, around her mother-in-law, Joanna. So it's likely that she wanted to meet Stephen in public places to avoid any tense run-ins with his mother. By April 2009, Heather and Stephen's divorce was in its final stages, and they were still meeting up on the weekends for bi-weekly custody exchanges. And that brings us back to April 26, 2009, just after 6 p.m., when multiple witnesses watched someone approach Heather Stroob in a Target parking lot as she strapped her son into his car seat. Heather argued with this person and tried to get in the driver's seat of her vehicle, but a horrific scream rang out across the parking lot, followed by a gunshot. The first officer on the scene got the distraught 18-month-old Carson out of his car seat and placed him safely in a patrol car. More law enforcement and crime scene investigators soon arrived and began processing the scene. Heather was discovered lying on her back, near the rear driver's side tire of her vehicle, a pool of blood forming on the pavement beneath her. She had been shot once in the head. Police immediately secured the scene and began questioning the witnesses who had watched the tragedy unfold. Several witnesses described a short male, small in stature, wearing a button-down shirt and khaki pants. The suspect had what was described as a mop of black hair on his head that some witnesses believed could have been a wig. Witnesses also noticed the suspect's black mustache and distinctive nose. The suspect had approached Heather after she strapped Carson into his car seat and followed her around to the driver's side of the vehicle. Witnesses heard some sort of argument ensue before Heather screamed and the suspect fired one shot into Heather's forehead. Investigators noticed several security cameras along the outside of the Target building, and they quickly moved to view the footage. The frustrating thing about the parking lot cameras was that instead of staying fixed in one position, the camera that investigators were focused on would pan from left to right across the parking lot. In the footage, they were able to spot Heather's burgundy Cadillac Escalade toward the back of the lot, exactly where it was found when investigators arrived on the scene. The camera panned to the left, and then when it panned back to the right, they watched as Steven Strube's green minivan pulled into the lot, driving toward Heather's car. But the camera panned to the left again, so investigators were not able to see the actual custody exchange taking place. After a few minutes, as the camera panned to the right, they spotted Steven's green minivan leaving the parking lot just before 6 p.m. One key piece of footage that was captured was what appeared to be the suspect that witnesses had described walking across the parking lot toward Heather's vehicle. But once again, the camera panned away. The murder was not captured on surveillance footage. As the camera panned back across the lot, the suspect was nowhere to be seen. But what investigators did see was a pixelated figure on the ground near the rear driver's side tire of Heather's vehicle. It was Heather. Hoping to find a clearer view of the suspect, investigators viewed footage from a security camera that overlooked the entrance to the parking lot. And sure enough, just before 6 p.m., their suspect was captured in his strange black wig, button-down shirt, and khaki pants, carrying a shoulder bag. The suspect walked briskly toward the parking lot, and it was then that investigators noticed the distinctive gait with which the subject walked. Not quite a limp, but some sort of hitch in his steps. A few minutes later, the suspect was captured on that security camera again, leaving along the same walkway upon which he had entered the parking lot. But oddly, the suspect wasn't running away from the scene. He walked hastily, but calmly. Because the suspect was captured on surveillance footage fleeing the scene on foot, tracking dogs were brought in to try to determine where the suspect had fled to. It's unclear how the dogs picked up the suspect's scent, but they followed the trail around the left side of the Target building, along the walkway where the suspect was seen fleeing. The dogs traced the scent all the way to a hotel parking lot behind the Target, but there, the dogs lost the trail, leading investigators to believe that the suspect had gotten into a vehicle and driven away. Police questioned a few people at the hotel, including front desk workers, but no one had any recollection of seeing their suspect at the hotel or around the parking lot. Every piece of evidence gathered so far pointed to a carefully planned, targeted attack on Heather Strube.
When it comes to Father's Day, dads want steak. And there's still time to deliver uncompromising quality and flavor with delicious gifts from America's original butcher, Omaha Steaks. Plus, get an extra $35 off with code THANKSDAD when you shop at omahasteaks.com today. Hurry, there's still time to give Dad something incredible for the big day. Shop now at omahasteaks.com and get an extra $35 off with code THANKSDAD. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Heather's autopsy was performed the day after the murder. She was shot once in the forehead. The medical examiner recovered a bullet from her body that was later determined to be a .38 caliber, most likely fired from either a Rossi or Taurus handgun. When police broke the news to Stephen Strube, he was devastated. He broke down and was visibly distraught by his ex-wife's murder. Even so, investigators still had to question him, as he was the last known person to have contact with Heather before she was murdered. Stephen was living with his mother, Joanna, at the time, and he said that on Sunday, April 26th, he spent the day at home with his girlfriend, Carson, and Joanna. Stephen told police that his mother had left the house about 15 minutes before he and his girlfriend both left, which was shortly before 6 p.m., as Stephen was scheduled to make the custody exchange with Heather at Target at 6 p.m. that evening. According to Stephen, after he dropped Carson off with Heather, he went straight back home. Heather's boyfriend at the time, Mike Vickers, was also questioned by police. He was absolutely heartbroken by her death, and as it turned out, he had a solid alibi for the time of the murder and was quickly cleared of any suspicion. Investigators asked witnesses to work with a forensic sketch artist in an attempt to create a clearer picture of the suspect's face. Hopefully, a face that someone would recognize. But when the sketch was shown to Heather's parents, Buddy and Mary, they could not think of a single person who resembled the artist's rendering. In fact, no one close to Heather recognized the person in the sketch. Hoping to garner some sort of lead in the case, investigators released the forensic artist's sketch to the media. 2 days after Heather's murder, someone called police with a tip about the sketch that was released. The tipster stated that they had been staying in the hotel behind the Target where Heather was murdered. Just days before the murder, the tipster saw someone in a white pickup truck wearing what appeared to be a strange black wig and a fake mustache, casing out the Target store. The tipster said the person in the truck was either using binoculars to watch the Target or was taking photographs of the area. Police received another call from a long-haul trucker who had also been staying at the hotel. The trucker told police that he had seen a person of the same description, wearing a crazy black wig and a fake mustache, get into an older model white Ford F-150 pickup truck and drive away. The key to this tip, however, was that the trucker distinctly remembered a unique black molding that ran along the side of the truck. When the trucker told police that he would be able to confidently identify the truck if he saw it, police asked him to ride along with them to a specific house in the area to see if he recognized any of the vehicles in the driveway. And when they drove past the house in question, the trucker immediately spotted the truck that he had seen in the hotel parking lot just days earlier. The 1991 white Ford F-150 with the distinctive black side molding was registered to Joanna Hayes, Stephen Strube's mother. Strangely, however, there was no one who lived at Joanna's house or who was connected to Joanna who looked like the suspect described by multiple witnesses. Still, police moved to obtain a search warrant for Joanna's pickup truck. On April 29th, 2009, 3 days after Heather Strube's murder, police served a search warrant on the truck and interviewed Joanna at her home. Joanna told investigators that while she would never hurt Heather, she was not very fond of her. She stated that in her opinion, Heather was, quote-unquote, not a good parent morally, and that she was, quote-unquote, not good enough to raise her grandson. She also stated that Heather had learned her poor parenting skills from her own mother. Despite the candid manner in which she expressed her low opinions of Heather, Joanna insisted that she wouldn't go so far as to murder her grandson's mother. Joanna told investigators that on the day of the murder, she left the house before Stephen left with Carson. She was going to her parents' house to do some maintenance for them. She also informed police that there was no way she could have committed the murder, because she was near the town of Luthersville, purchasing a Frosty from Wendy's at 7:19 p.m., nearly an hour and a half after Heather was shot. The Wendy's was about 70 miles away from the Target in Snellville, Georgia, where the murder had taken place. Interestingly, Joanna also informed police that they could find a receipt from that Wendy's in her truck, dated April 26, 2009 at 7:19 p.m. She claimed that there was no possible way she could have shot Heather at 6 p.m. that evening, and then made it all the way to the Wendy's to purchase her Frosty at 7:19 p.m. Investigators searched Joanna's truck, which had been deep cleaned into pristine condition. The only viable piece of evidence collected from the truck was a 4-inch-long black fiber. When investigators consulted an expert, it was determined that that fiber very likely came from a wig. It was then that police realized perhaps the suspect's crazy black mop of hair was a wig, and perhaps the suspect was not a man, but a woman in disguise. Investigators did in fact find the Wendy's receipt in Joanna's truck, and it seemed to confirm that she indeed bought a Frosty at 7:19 p.m. on the evening of the murder. But how true was Joanna's claim that she could not possibly have committed the murder at 6 p.m. and purchased a Frosty 70 miles away at 7:19 p.m.? Investigators decided to find out for themselves. They drove to the Target in Snellville, where Heather was murdered and left at 6 p.m. Driving the speed limit the entire route, they arrived at the Wendy's near Luthersville, Georgia at 7:20 p.m. This experiment led to the conclusion that Joanna Hayes very well could have murdered Heather Strube at 6 p.m. and arrived at the Wendy's in time to purchase that Frosty that she attempted to use as her alibi. On May 5th, 2009, 9 days after Heather's murder, police brought Stephen Strube to the police department for further questioning. Early in the interview, detectives asked Stephen directly if he thought his mother, Joanna Hayes, could be capable of murdering his ex-wife. At first, Stephen more or less denied it. When detectives asked, quote, "What do you think? Could it have been your mom?" end quote, to which Stephen replied, quote, "I would seriously hope not," end quote. Moments later, detectives asked again, quote, "Could it be her?" end quote. Stephen replied, quote, "I do not think it could be. I mean, like you said, she's got a temper, but that," end quote. Detectives then showed Stephen the surveillance footage of the suspect entering and leaving the Target parking lot, asking him if he recognized anything about the person. And Stephen did in fact recognize the suspect's distinctive, stiff-legged gait. As he watched the footage, he said, quote unquote, "Oh my God," in absolute disbelief, as though the reality of what had happened to Heather was fully setting in. Stephen then said, dumbfounded, quote, "That's why she called me and said, you need to go and get Carson," end quote. And that comment solidified the detective's belief that they were on the right track. Detectives presented Stephen with the forensic artist's sketch of the suspect and asked him if that sketch resembled his mother, to which Stephen remarked that if they removed the hair and the mustache, it would resemble his mother. He also noted the unique nose of the person in the sketch, saying, quote unquote, "That's exactly her nose." Stephen became distraught and commented that he felt like he was going to throw up. Through his tears, he asked detectives what they wanted him to do. Detectives asked Stephen to make a phone call to his mother so that it could be recorded. So they took him out to one of their patrol cars and had him call Joanna. Joanna answered the phone with a cheerful "Hey," but Stephen was in clear distress. To his mother's lively greeting, he replied, quote, "I just left the police station and they showed me the videotape. It looks like you," end quote. Joanna replied incredulously, quote, "It looks like me," end quote. Stephen then said, quote, "It looks just like you, walks like you. Why did you do it?" end quote. There was a brief pause before Joanna said, quote, "I didn't, Stephen," end quote. Stephen pushed, quote, "Did you do it? Seriously, do not lie to me," end quote. But Joanna continued to deny any involvement. She then said, quote, "So you told them you think it's me," end quote. To which Stephen said yes. Joanna then said, quote, "So I guess they'll be coming here tonight to arrest me then, huh?" end quote. 2 days after that recorded phone call, Joanna was brought to the police department for an interview. Throughout the entire interview, Joanna was defiant and aggressive. When detectives showed her the surveillance footage of the suspect, she retorted, quote unquote, "That's supposed to be me?" When asked if she had ever owned a gun, Joanna said that she herself had never owned a gun, but that her ex-husband did, and when they divorced, he took any guns they had. At the end of the interview, Joanna told detectives in no uncertain terms that when they had actual evidence against her, they could find her. She then promptly walked out of the room. On June 25th, 2009, 2 months after Heather's murder, detectives tracked down Joanna Hayes' ex-husband to interview him. Her ex-husband informed them that during their marriage, he had purchased Joanna a .38 caliber Lady Rossi handgun, and that when they divorced, she kept the gun. It wasn't until nearly 9 months after Heather's murder that the case moved forward. In December 2009, Joanna Hayes was arrested following her indictment on charges of murder, aggravated assault, and possession of a firearm. Shortly after Joanna's arrest, Stephen Strube was also arrested for violating his probation for a 2008 conviction. The trial began in early May 2011, 2 years after Heather's murder. Several witnesses testified during the trial, including a man who had worked with Joanna making deliveries for Heather's flower shop in 2008. The man recalled that while riding together during a delivery, Joanna had once described how she would murder someone and get away with it. Joanna told the co-worker that she could easily form an alibi by using a credit card close to the time of the murder, but at a location far away from the crime scene. She also told this co-worker that she could purchase a gun from one of the laborers at any of the construction sites where she worked, and that she could easily destroy the weapon using a grinder or a plasma torch. The co-worker recalled that Joanna owned both grinders and plasma torches that she kept in her home workshop. Joanna's ex-husband also testified, telling the jury that when he made the decision to leave Joanna, she took the very handgun that he had purchased for her and pointed it at his forehead, threatening to kill him. After 3 weeks of testimony, the jury was dismissed to begin their deliberations. On May 27, 2011, after 2.5 days of deliberation, Joanna Hayes was found guilty of the murder of Heather Strube. She was sentenced to life in prison, with the possibility of parole after 30 years. Heather's parents, Buddy and Mary Allen, were granted custody of Carson shortly after Heather's murder. They have had full custody of him since. Carson is now 16 years old, and according to Buddy and Mary, he is thriving. They have said that they have strived every single day to raise Carson in a way that Heather would be proud of. Heather Strube was a hardworking, ambitious, devoted mother, embarking on a brand new chapter in her life, a chapter that she was excited about. And that was all ripped away from her by someone so controlling and self-centered and malicious that they would rather Heather be dead than be the one to raise their grandson. A baby boy had to listen to the sound of the gunshot that took his mother's life as he cried for her. A gunshot that was delivered by someone who should have been a loving protector to him as he grew up. Someone who murdered a young mother in front of her baby because she couldn't temper the jealousy she felt toward her. I hope sincerely that Heather's family, especially her son, are living full, happy lives. And though time can never heal such a grievous wound, I hope they are at peace with the fact that the person who stole her away from them will spend their life behind bars.
If you'd like to request a case to be covered on the show, you'll find a link to a case request form in the show notes. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel, where you'll find full episodes, complete with photos relevant to each case. You can follow the podcast on X, formerly Twitter, at Crime Again Pod, on Instagram at Crime Again Podcast, and on TikTok at Crime Again Podcast. Links to all social media can be found in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode of Crime and Crime Again.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own. surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.